Welcome to the latest Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast, brought to you from the Aquarium Rush Studios in downtown Grand Rapids, Michigan. My name's Ben.
I'm Charles.
And I am not Amy.
Right. So Amy is out with COVID this week.
Ha-ha.
Wow.
Look, the stand-in's getting cocky already. Yes, but don't worry. Amy will be back next time. Hopefully that's going to be soon. I think it's going to be soon. Well, we're going to do some... Just keep listening because we're going to do fun stuff because that's what we do around here. But first, it's shameless plug time. Oh, wait.
Amy's the one that does that. Hey, go to our website. Check out. We've got live plants. We've got all these dry goods like heaters and filters and stuff.
And merch. Cool
and merch.
And
yes.
What is that website?
WatercolorsAquariumGallery.com.
One more time just for fun.
WatercolorsAquariumGallery.com.
There we go. That's our shameless plug. Yes, so many of you have probably heard us talk about Nick in the past. Most of the time we talk about Nick, it's good. He is the one who typically edits the podcast, so he's got a little bit of an idea what's going on.
When it's not good, I just edit it out. So
so when this episode's like 20 minutes long, we know what happened.
Right. So, you know, be a little patient with us. We'll get all this stuff worked out. And, you know, if you go to the website and you buy more stuff, we'll get better at this and get more techie stuff. And then maybe we could, you know, remote work Amy in. That's totally a lie. I offered to see if she wanted to do this remote and she's really not feeling well. So she is sleeping instead of doing the podcast and she is allowed to do that and is well deserved.
And we are going to have a little break between our next podcast coming out after this one because...
No, we're not.
We're not, really.
No, we're not. No, we got a plan.
Oh.
It's just going to be a little different. There will be a break because I'm going to be in Thailand.
Mm-hmm. You just got to brag.
I know. I did a little bit. Hopefully, I'm going to go get some pictures of some bettas in the wild. That's one of my goals there. But this episode has nothing to do with bettas or Thailand or Amy.
Yeah.
Really nothing to do with Nick either.
No, too bad.
We told him to come in anyway just to hang out with us because...
Because we need someone to run the machine.
Right.
And if you buy a lot of merch, they'll replace my job with a robot.
Ooh. Yeah, now we're talking.
Sold.
So today we are going to talk about a... well, you know we're really big cichlid fans here.
Yeah.
Actually, we are cichlid fans. We just tend to push on the...
tend to rag on a particular type of cichlid keeper.
Right. You know, people come in the door and they say, hey, where's your cichlids? Well, they're standing in front of an angelfish tank.
Yeah, and exactly.
Like, oh, no, I mean the African cichlids. Well, they're standing in front of a tank full of Pelphicochromis.
Yep.
Right.
No, I mean the cool ones.
Well, they're standing in front of a tank of Pelphicochromis with the pistos in the background. Anyway, no.
Yeah, I recently got called out by one of our employees where she goes, yeah, for a guy who on the podcast claims to not be a cichlid guy, you spend a lot of time explaining to people why they should like cichlids because they're not all like that.
That is kind of the deal with cichlids. I mean, we were talking about the most diverse family of fish on the planet when we were saying cichlid.
I think when you're talking about bony fish species, I think described cichlid species account for about 8% of the described teleost fish in the world.
That's ridiculous.
That's insane.
Right. We're not talking about fish from Lake Malawi, which is what, can we call them cichlid bros on here?
Yes.
Yeah.
We may.
Cichlid bros, like, where are you cichlids at?
Right. We're not talking about Malawi cichlids. We're not talking about African cichlids or Rift Lake cichlids. We're talking about fish from the other side of the pond. This is the Earth group of fish called the Earth Eaters.
Yeah. I think that would be the tribe Geophaginae.
That makes sense. It does encompass more than just the genus Geophagus, which actually means earth eater in Latin or Greek. Probably Latin, right?
I think Greek is geo, and then I think phagus is Latin, actually.
Well, that's the fun thing about scientific names is you can combine that stuff.
Yeah. Watch me put a corrections in the notes where I have it all wrong.
Right, exactly. Yep. Before we go into geos, we do need to do a little shout out, sympathetic shout out to a huge loss in the aquarium hobby that happened recently. And actually, the note thing is what reminded me because we lost Jake Adams, who definitely a saltwater, a huge member of the saltwater aquarium keeping community. But he was a big freshwater keeping guy too. He called Charles a couple of times with episto information and questions and things like that.
He was actually a listener to the podcast, a little bit more avid than I would let on. He would send me notes of corrections of things we said in the podcast. So if you've noticed in the last month and a half or so, I've started putting corrections or addendums in the descriptions where warranted. Those are either notes directly from him, or I was trying to prevent him from getting on our tail. But it's in his spirit.
Yep, for sure. Well, our sympathies go out to his family and to the whole reefing community. He was pretty much the driving force behind the Reef Builders site, which is a site that I reference on a regular basis. Go check out that site and remember those people in your thoughts. It's a big loss.
Yeah.
Anyway, on to fun stuff. Let's talk about geos, Charles.
I have the perfect quote about geos.
They're goofy looking fish.
So it's from Thomas Wiedner from the March-April 2015 Amazonas article. He said, South American earth eaters occupy a curious niche in the aquarium world. For some, they are too big, for others too small. But for a dedicated core of enthusiasts, they are just right, scoring high points for their iridescent hues, droll personalities, and fascinating feeding behaviors.
I think that's a pretty accurate description of those guys.
I couldn't think of a better, more concise way of talking about them. Like, that's it.
Yeah, that's it. We're good. All right. Thanks for listening.
That's
everybody.
A wrap.
No, I'm just kidding. We're going to talk about detail.
Yeah. So where did you want to start?
So let's talk about what does it mean to be an earth eater?
Why are you looking at me?
So what do you think of, Nick, when you think of the word earth eater?
So full transparency, I am the least educated on this topic at the table. We sell a couple pretty frequently, the micro geophagus, a couple of them species.
Which are not earth eaters.
Are they not?
Well,
it depends on how you define it.
It does.
I was going to say, I'm already showing that I know right? a little.
Right. They are micro geophagus, which is the scientific name, which does mean little earth eater.
Right.
Because they were originally in the same genus as the geophagus genus. They were originally part of that genus, and so they were separated out as little guys. But they don't do that really cool, fascinating behavior. Although there is another fish that is included on the list of earth eaters that also doesn't do the behavior. So
yeah,
are they included? Are they not included? You know,
so
I think we should say they're included.
Yeah, if you go at the subfamily level, which would be Geophaginidae, that would include Microgeophagus. If you go at the tribe level, that would be Geophagini. Okay. It would not include them.
They would not. Do they include Acarichthys? In that tribe?
Not in my notes, okay. No.
Okay. One of the sites I referenced, Get to Know the Earth Eaters, talked about Acarichthys in that group. One of the sites that I referenced in that talked about Acarichthys as being in that group, but did not talk about Microgeophagus as being in that group. But Acarichthys does not sift. Okay, so earth eater. They're really cool to watch, particularly if you have a sand bottom tank, because what they constantly do is move about the tank, grab up a mouthful of sand, sift it around for any good little bits and pieces, and then spit the sand back out. And the hardcore earth eaters like the Satanoperchas, the Gymnogeophagus, and the Geophagus are constantly doing that. And it's a really cool behavior to watch. The Bolivian rams, which is Microgeophagus, is that Altospinosis?
Sounds right.
Or spinosis. Anyway,
it's Altospinosis.
Do that to a certain extent, but the classic German blue ram or the classic ram, they don't do that at all.
Yeah, it's actually kind of cool. So everything in that subfamily I mentioned, they all share this one feature called a epibranchial lobe, and it's a specialized gill feature where there's like a sac-like extension at the epibranchial one, which would be the first brachial gill arch. And that's actually like, this is very specific, and I wanted to be that specific because that means that all the fish in that subfamily, that's their defining features, okay. That specific extension in that specific gill arch.
And I would assume that that is the part of their gill that acts as a sifting mechanism.
Yeah, it seems to be a lobe that separates the oral cavity from the throat cavity, meaning that food particles cannot escape. What's really funny about it to me is that going back through literature, it actually took a while for people to settle on that it was a sand sifting feature, because that same feature is really advantageous if you're a mouth brooder.
Oh, sure. Because then you don't swallow the babies.
Exactly.
But it's not something that all the mouth brooders have.
Exactly.
Okay. Do you know if the genus Calochromis, I believe it's Calochromis, there's a group of earth eaters from Lake Tanganyika?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I'll admit that I'm not very well versed in cichlid taxonomic anatomy. But I will say that part of why cichlids have diversified so readily is that, and this is just cool evolutionary thing, is they have a specific gene set that means that their jaw is very easily mutated in ways that are advantageous, so that they can very quickly fill a new niche in a way that other fish clades can't.
Oh, I get that.
Because if you can change your jaw really fast generationally,
right,
you can do something completely new as a population. But yeah, that's one of the things that I, like, literally days ago learned about cichlids that made me go, you know, that makes a lot more sense why they can just move into a niche and immediately fill it.
Right, right. And they definitely fill those niches.
Do you want me to give the list of the genera that are in that subfamily that share this specific feature?
Yes, let's see if it matches my list.
Okay, so subfamily Geophaginae includes, now keep in mind, this might not be exactly accurate to what list you're looking at or what the list at home you're looking at, because, and this is really cool context, 7 years ago, there were 19 described species of Geophagus. Right now, I could find 31.
Wow.
So it's a clade of organisms very much in shift. But from what I could find, Biotodoma, mm-hmm. Geophagus, mm-hmm. Gymnogeophagus, mm-hmm. Satanaperca, mm-hmm. Epistogramma, Epistogrammoides, Microgeophagus, and Tayniacara. And that's, so then the tribe Geophaginae would be what more like, you would sort out the ones that you would, like Epistogramma, Epistogrammoides, Microgeophagus, and I think Tayniacara, and then the rest of them would be in that tribe.
So they didn't include Guanacara or Acarichthys?
Not the from the list I saw, but that doesn't mean they're not there. It just means they weren't there on the list I saw.
Okay. I'm sure those would be in the clade.
Or they got sorted into some other genus along the way.
Yeah.
Interesting. Like I said, this topic is going to be really, because in the past when we've done groups, we've usually limited ourselves to a genus, not a clade in flux.
Yeah. And I think that this is one that you have to talk about it as the group. And, you know, I know Acarichthys, for example, was spun off of Geophagus, or Geophagus off of Acarichthys. But Acarichthys heckeli used to be in the same genus as Geophagus cernumensis, but they're not anymore. Those are split. And the Guanacara, I believe I'm saying that correctly, I believe that used to be part of Biotodoma. But don't quote me on that. Don't quote me on the second one.
There's going to be so many corrections at the end of this.
Well, and like you said, there's 33 species in there.
31
species, and there used to be
19 as of 7 years ago.
Okay, and now 31.
Why do you think that is? Are more being described, or are they
more being described? There is also just a trend towards because they have ornamental value. What's happening is that forms or populations are being discovered before they can be formally described by taxonomists. So like, that's why when you see things like today, we were talking about Betta CF stigmosa. That's not Betta stigmosa. That's a new population or form of Betta that the nearest thing that we as hobbyists can figure out it's related to is Betta stigmosa, but some taxonomist is going to have to come along and sort it out officially, quote unquote, for us.
So you think they've been collected over the years, but as of recently, they're starting to describe them a little better?
Or,
yes. Okay, cool.
And that also means that like in the last decade, these larger groups, meaning like not just at the genus level, but at this tribe and subfamily level, stuff's getting sorted around a lot. And it can vary depending on which scientist you're talking to, because if a guy 2 years ago is using the data set of, and I'm just throwing out numbers, of 25 species instead of 31, those extra six species might give you enough data to give you new insights as to what may or may not be there at the higher level.
My suspicion is it's going to go down a little bit like Crenocicla and Epistogramma, where these groups are so diversified. Okay, so let's talk about Gymnogeophagus for a minute, right? Gymnogeophagus are primarily found in Uruguay, which is subtropical. Some of them can take temperatures down to like 45 degrees.
Yeah,
and are fine.
That's weird.
I actually read that if you want to breed all but one species of them, and I don't know how true this is, is that you need to give them a quote-unquote cool face.
Yeah, they're seasonal breeders. But there's something like 7 described and 14 undescribed Gymnogeophagus.
From the list I found, 18 described species.
18, okay. And that's just in Uruguay.
Yeah.
Right? And Uruguay, compared to the size of Brazil or the Amazon River Basin, of which Uruguay is not a part of the Amazon River Basin, parts of it are. Anyway, if you look at the size and the scale of Brazil and the species diversification that happens and has been identified in the Amazon River Basin, we're just touching the surface of these guys. So the reason Epistogramma and Crenocicla are so diverse is because they've been studied. And each little tributary of the Amazon River, the whole system has a different species of Episto and a different species of Crenocicla, not to mention a different species of Corydoras and so on down the line. And I think that's going to be the same thing with these gymnos.
Yeah. I have in my notes that Geophagus right now has 31 described species and probably an additional 10 forms that haven't been officially described. And I could find indications that the number is probably at the end of like all this is probably going to end up sorted or somewhere in the 50 to 60 species range.
I think that's, I bet it's going to be more than that. I just, the diversification that happens there is just.
I would think it would be not as, me personally, I don't think it's going to be as diverse as Epistos, only because geos, at least from what I can see, are more mobile. And so in my interpretation, they're not going to be as extreme as like Discus, where there's like 4 species in the entire Amazon River Basin. Mm-hmm. But I think they're going to sort out not as diverse as Epistos, because they come from the larger streams and they're more mobile.
That could be. But did you look at Gymnogeophagus melanogens? And then CF melanogens, and then CF melanogens 2, and then CF melanogens 3, and so on down the line?
No, I didn't really look further than genus level taxonomy on stuff. Okay. And I will admit that because this entire group is actually fairly new to me. Everything I've talked about in them, I've learned in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay, right.
You guys had weeks to prepare? I had 2 or 3 hours.
That's what we appreciate about you, Nick. Let's just do it on the fly, and you're good for it. You can handle it, man. You can handle it. Anyway, okay. So there's the diversification. Now let's talk about the groups.
Yeah. I think, of course, Geophagus, obviously. Satanoperca. Now, I couldn't find an exact number of species on those, because most of the literature I could find sorts that genus into 2 subgenera. Mm-hmm. There was the Daimon group and the Juripari group.
Right.
And apparently they're different enough. I don't like
spots or no spots.
Interesting. Biototoma, Gymnotodoma, Gymnogeophagnus, and I also have Acarichthys, which you mentioned in my earlier. From my notes, that's a monotypic genus.
Right. Heckeli is the one.
Okay.
And that's the one that doesn't actually sift.
Do you mind, Charles, for my sake, while you go through these groups, maybe mention what you see in the aquarium hobby or some of these species, some of these groups?
He would be better for that than me.
Okay. So the Satanoperca, which by the way means Satan's perch.
I've seen them before here in the shop.
Yes.
And they sound badass, but they don't look
not at all
like the name describes them to be.
They're called the Satan's perch because they sort of look like a goat head.
Oh, okay. That's where the name comes. I didn't think that, but I could see that.
Silly looking like a goat. I like goats. They're adorably silly looking, right? And I would say that the Satanoperca genus, that's got that.
I remember when we had, I can't remember which species, but...
I think it was Juripari, actually.
We had Juripari and we had Damon.
Okay.
Yeah, it was one of the two we had in, and Amy said, she was looking at him, she goes, that thing really looks like it eats earth. Like she described it, like the kid on the playground who eats dirt. Like he's got that look to him.
I would say that's accurate. Yep.
I thought it was funny.
I kept a group of Juriparis. I had six of them in a 90-gallon tank, which is okay for a little while. They're going to get into the 9-inch range, which means they're going to outgrow a 90-gallon tank. I would put them at a 120 of a minimum size. The Damons get a little bit bigger. Was it 9 inches? Hang on. Got to refer to my notes here again. 7 inches for the Juriparis, 9 inches plus for the Damons and for some of the other ones in the group. The other ones in the group, I found that there were maybe seven others in that genus. I have never seen, there's one other that I have seen in the hobby once. The rest of them I've never seen in the hobby.
Is this the kind of thing where like, if there's some hardcore like geo guy out there, he might have some of the weird ones?
It's very possible.
Okay. Kind of like with like Epistos, where there are those weird guys that go out and collect them themselves.
Yeah, for sure. Yep, for sure.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so that's Satanoperca, Satan's perch. And oh, by the way, Satanoperca Damon, it's not demon, it's Damon, which is a protective god.
Hmm, yeah.
So it's the protective god demon perch.
Spooky.
I know, right?
It's coming at you on all sides.
What was the next one?
Biotodoma.
So Biotodoma cupido is the, I'm going to say the common one of a group of extremely uncommon fish. I think I've had them, I've never kept them personally. I've had them in a store once. They are a true, like, they might even be okay with discus as long as their attitude stays in check, but they like it hot. They do want you to mess with, you got to mess with the water a little bit with those guys.
In my notes I have, and this is literally what says, less plant nibbly ?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. A lot of the geos are not, they're not necessarily going to be plant eaters, but they sift the sand.
They're bound to disturb whatever you plant there.
Yeah, exactly. So I did potted plants and Anubias in my in my earth eater tank.
Generally speaking, do you are earth eaters fish you want to keep in groups, or
they definitely want to be in a group?
That was what I was expecting, right. But yeah.
Yeah. And one of the challenges with the Juriparis is they take like 4 years to mature.
Wow. Oh god.
Right. So some of the other fish in this group are mature in, you know, 6 months to a year. But the Juriparis, you just gotta keep growing and growing and growing to get the Juriparis big enough. And mine were 4.5 inches, and everybody I talked to said, yeah, you got about a year or two yet before they're going to be big enough to breed.
So, yay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you see that project through?
I did not.
No. Nope.
I kept them for about 2 years, and then I had them in with another group of earth eaters that were way more fun and way more interesting.
You moved on.
And just as goofy looking.
So, wait, can we go? What were they?
That would be in the Gymnophagus genus.
Okay, that's next on my list. So okay. Let's talk about those.
Perfect. Convenient.
So that one is divided into two groups. The, I think it's the Serenamensis group. Is that the one, what they call that group?
I don't have that kind of notation. I just have the genus level, which doesn't mean that grouping doesn't exist. It just means I didn't find it.
Okay, it's the Brasiliensis group. That's what the other one is. And that's going to include a lot of what people would call the classic earth eaters, which is Sirenomensis brasiliensis, the redhead tapajos, not tapajo.
Wait, are we talking Gymnogeophagus or
this
Geophagus?
Is Geophagus.
Okay, sorry.
Geophagus. That's that whole group. Peach-faced tapajo, red-headed tapajo, Sirenomensis brasiliensis. There's a couple others in that
group. How did you pronounce that one group?
Tapajos?
No, the Carabalabrensis? How did you said a group name. And
brasiliensis or Sirenomensis?
Sirenomensis. Yeah. Okay.
So Sirenomensis being from Suriname.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Then... And those are, that's a pretty diverse group, but it's got that classic, they're gorgeous fish once they mature. That whole group is, they're some of my favorites. They don't look goofy like the Satanoperchas and the other part of the Geophagus group. They get some pretty stately looking fish. The streamers that you can get on a Sirenomensis are gorgeous. And they'll breed much, much younger. The peach face and the redhead tapajos are some of the easiest to breed in this group. Almost as easy as the other group, the red hump earth eater.
Is this right?
Steindachneri.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. I actually have those written in my notes as, so I think it's pronounced Crassilebris group, which includes Steindachneri, are considered model organisms for ovophile mouth brooding by behavioral biologists.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Probably that would be ovophile. That means they pick up the eggs, not the babies, because some of the geophagus, many of them are mouth brooders, not all. Some of the geophagus grab the eggs and incubate the eggs and hold those until they're baby fish. Some of those lay the eggs and substrate spawn the eggs, and as soon as they hatch, they collect up the fry.
Yeah, from my... In my notes, I could find ovophile mouth brooding and larvophile mouth brooding,
right?
Which would be the collecting the fry that you're describing.
Yeah.
So these two strategies, do you think they're developed based on habitat or?
Usually mouth brooding is developed based on predators, right? So where the larva, what's that word?
Larvophile.
Larvophile mouth brooders, there probably are less egg predators, but plenty of fry predators.
Sure.
Where the ovophile mouth brooders are, there's probably way more egg predators.
So an adaptive strategy.
Yes.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
And part of what's fascinating is the implication that behavioral biologists are working with this group indicates that there's a degree of behavioral plasticity depending on variables in the environment, which would coincide with what you're saying.
Yeah. Cool.
The Steindachneris I kept them in the 90. They bred like crazy in the 90, and I actually had to slow them down because I would just get brood upon brood of very, very easy to raise, 30 or 40 fry every batch. And I flooded the local aquarium club with them, and I flooded the local aquarium stores with them in a very short amount of time because they're so extremely prolific. They were really fun, and they do get goofy. They do get a really cool, they're called the red hump earth eater because it looks like when you look at the knuckle hump on a frontosa, right? It almost makes it look a little stately. On the red hump earth eater, it looks like a little hump on his head. Like, it looks like
he walked into a wall.
Yeah, like Bugs Bunny thumped him with a baseball bat. And, you know, you have the little lines come out like the cartoon throbbing lines out of where that red hump comes out of that. So goofy. I loved them. They were little cartoon character fish, and they'd like look at you, just grab a mouthful of dirt and spit it out right while they're looking at you. Like
you did have a phase in your fish keeping where you liked odd fish, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say I haven't left that phase.
I'm there with you.
Yeah.
So I feel like we've kind of like through some of the groups and stuff. So let's say you want to get into keeping earth eaters. What's your advice?
Start with a big tank.
How big?
90?
I think 90 would be minimum. So I guess technically you could do a 75 because you don't really need the height with earth eaters. They're going to be bottom-dwelling fish. I would do a sand bottom with all of them.
Do you have a particular type of sand you prefer?
A silica sand.
Okay.
But, you know, something that looks rather South American-like. I think I was probably using the sandblasting sand or pool filter sand. We've kind of switched away from that around here because we've noticed that the local pool filter sand does seem to have an effect on pH.
Yeah.
Many of them, like the Steindachneri, don't care about pH and hardness. Some of them definitely do, like the Biotodoma cupido.
Yeah, and I actually have it in my notes that keeping them in sand is actually like a biological imperative for them because the incidental ingestion of sand aids in digestion for them.
Oh, that makes sense.
And it keeps them healthy. And in the sense that, so they have this specialized feature in their gill arch. It's designed to be abraded constantly.
Oh.
As in, without that abrasion, it will grow too much, or what?
I'm not sure exactly, but the implication is that without that stimulus, this feature doesn't function as well.
Interesting.
So
yeah, I can see that. That's cool. One of my favorite ways to feed these fish would really bring out their behavior. I would take a regular decent size fish aquarium net, and I would go out to my pond and I would drudge the bottom and just get whatever was there. And it would be leaf litter and it would be insect larvae and nymphs. And I guess insect larvae and nymphs is redundant in saying the same thing, isn't it? anyway, it would be all kind of just junk that was on the bottom of the tank. And I would grab that and they'd see me coming with that net and they behaved as many intelligent fish do when you come at them with a bowl with a can of fish food, right? Like they can recognize that kind of fish food as food. They would see me coming with that net, you'd see them get all excited. And I'd dump that in and it would settle to the bottom and they would just be charging and grabbing it and sifting it through and grabbing it and sifting it through. And I would come in with multiple golf ball size globs of stuff from my pond and they would devour all of it. The leaf litter, the bugs, whatever stuff was in there, they would devour it. They loved it.
The Satanoperca we got in, that I think they had a certain smugness to them that I got used to. And so whenever you've told me this story, I've always pictured them like smugly being like, thanks, Dad, when they're done.
We actually have a service tank that the solution to the amount of light that they get was to put earth eaters in it. So we've got red hub earth eaters in a service tank.
Oh, that's so cool.
And I've heard that recommended kind of sporadically here at the shop, obviously with the right setup needed to introduce some sand sifting fish to kind of resolve problems like that.
They do an amazing job of it. Yep.
So circling back to how you used to feed that group of yours, I get a little sense of paranoia that could you introduce some bad things into your tank by feeding your fish in that way?
It's possible, but the likelihood of introducing a bacteria that's going to be problematic is extremely low.
Right.
We are temperate climate. Yes. And this is a tropical fish. I guess the risk would be higher if you were working with the, what was the group where we said? The gymnogeophagus that need a cool phase. I guess the risk would be higher with those theoretically.
Yeah.
But with the other ones, I would think it would be pretty low.
I think that if if there was a parasite introduced, I would see it on the fish in the pond. And if it's not on the fish in the pond, it's not going to get on my fish in the tank. So I wasn't worried about it, and I would be very comfortable doing that.
Sure.
If you're doing proper quarantine and husbandry procedures with the inhabitants of your pond, with the fish that go in your pond.
Hey, did you know that we quarantine fish here at Watercolors Aquarium Gallery?
That's right. then I think you'd be fine. But I think if you bought a bunch of feeder goldfish from a big box store and dump those into your pond as your pond inhabitants, then I think the risk of introduction would be higher.
Yeah, it could be a gamble.
Yeah.
Yep. So put another way, you're more worried about the risk of introduction from the stuff you, the keeper, put in the pond than what would naturally be in the pond.
Absolutely.
Perfect.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Did we cover all the groups? We didn't cover gymnos. We should talk about gymnos because gymnos are cool.
You should talk about gymnos because I don't know anything about them other than there are 18 described species and they need a cool face.
I kept Labiatus and I kept one other one in Allison. I can't remember the name of the other one. There's a longer, skinny one. I think that's Labiatus. Anyway, the gymnos get some amazing colors and you don't need a heater. In fact, you don't want a heater with the tank. because they're from Uruguay. Uruguay has a similar climate to northern Florida. So it freezes there sometimes. The water never freezes, but they get ice sometimes. I heard an aquarium club speaker do a talk on collecting in Uruguay. And this was a guy who went on collecting trips like one or two a year for many, many years. I think it was Spencer Jack. If you're listening out there, give us a shout out, Spencer. We need to reconnect because that was a really cool talk. But he said that the collecting trip to Uruguay, it was a collecting trip for Gymnogeophagus species. It was the only collecting trip he went on that he gained weight.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Because the food in Uruguay was just absolutely, in his words, incredible. Now he's a hardcore carnivore, and grilled foods in Uruguay is like a big thing. And so they would stay in their little villas, and they had these guided tours to go collect fish, and they didn't like get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go collect fish. They got up, they had a nice big breakfast, and they left at about 10. And when they were leaving, when they're getting in the trucks at 10 o'clock in the morning to go out on their collecting trips, the hosts would be starting the fires for grilling dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they were going to start grilling, getting the grill set up and barbecue setups ready in the morning for the meals they were going to prepare for that evening. They spent the whole day grilling, barbecuing. So anyway, there's a little side note for the gymnos. As Charles mentioned, some of them, all but one, and I think it's the melanogenus that doesn't need the cool down. I believe all of the rest of them will need a little bit of a cool down in order to get them to spawn. Other than that, so one of the things about a gymno is they sift sand and eat whatever is nutritionally available at the time. What that means to us as aquarists is they're not hard to feed. They're going to eat anything. They need a certain amount of roughage in their diet, but getting them to eat and eat whatever, they're going to find out if something is food by taking a bite of it. And if there's something nutritious in it, they'll get it. So feeding them, don't be picky. Introduce some frozen foods now and then. Pellet food that is high in vegetable matter is going to be important for these guys, because that's where a lot of the roughage is going to come from. And like I said, man, pond scum. Oh, they love the pond scum. And the substrate in that tank was the cleanest substrate that I've ever had in my entire life, because they constantly clean it.
So your reference to a little higher vegetation in their diet,
yeah.
Is that true of earth eaters in general?
I would say that's going to be across the board, yes, that roughage.
Sure.
Yeah, that makes sense, because most of, like, we were talking about the pond scum, mm-hmm. like, I mean, I imagine that's predominantly leaf litter and like wood chips and,
right.
you know, cellulose and
yeah.
But that would be a lot of roughage.
Yeah. They're, as far as tank mates with these guys, whether it's the geos or the gymno geos or any of them, with the gymnos, it's got to be stuff that can handle cooler water. And there are some other fish from Uruguay that can do that. Some of the plecos are found in some of the cooler water areas. Some of the larger quarries can handle that kind of stuff. Buenos Aires tetras can handle that cooler water.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
I think we maybe kept those together at the time.
Yeah, I think that was a good combination. That was with the geos, not with the gymnogeos.
Sorry, yes.
Yeah.
Would you say that quarry cats would benefit from an environment from geos? Because you just mentioned them,
yeah.
But if that sand is the cleanest you've ever get, the scariest thing to a quarry cat keeper, I should say, is that the sand isn't clean enough and they're going to get an infection.
That probably would work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like crop rotation.
Yeah
exactly. Yeah.
Hmm.
The only keeping distinction between the gymnos and the geos is temperature.
Okay.
Don't be afraid of the cool down period, right? Unless you live in Florida. Well, no, even if you live in Florida, put a heater in the tank for 3 months and then take the heater out.
Yeah.
They can take temperatures up into the 80s for a short period of time. They're not going to like it, but heat them up to 70, 75 degrees, even closer to 80, and then pull the heater out and let it cool back down. And that can be enough to stimulate the spawn right there.
Cool.
Yeah.
So if you had to pick 3 species of geos for a new geo keeper to try.
Well, it depends on what kind of store you have available. If you have a store like us available, I would go, like, I would start with Steindachneri.
Okay.
Easy, fun, and goofy. And then I would do the either the peach face tapajo or the redheaded tapajo. And then I don't know. Pick one.
Yeah.
The challenging ones in the group are the Biotodomas. The Acricthes, you want to do a little bit more with messing with water, but not much. And then the temperature change with the Gymnos, but these are not challenging cichlids to keep. The big thing to remember with geos is they get big. So if you want, you know, a rack of 20-gallon tanks, yeah, go get some Coolipistos.
Yeah.
One of the websites mentioned a 55 as the minimum. And I think that's not accurate.
Well, that's like a 12-inch width. Like, yeah. That's not enough.
I think a 55 is too small for really any of them, except for maybe the Guanacaras.
Okay.
But those guys want the water moving a little bit more, and you want to mess with the water a little bit, maybe some tannins, but for sure, maybe a 50-50 RO tap water combination just to get that TDS reading down a little bit.
What's a minimum group size? We mentioned they want to be keeping a group, but I don't think we gave a number.
You might be able to get away with a male and 2 females, but more is better. Most of them are harem breeders. The mouth brooders, I believe all of them are maternal mouth brooders. And so that means the male can have multiple females holding at a time. And typically when they can do that, they want to do that.
Can you blame them?
Right.
I mean, if you have some nice redheads that you
want. Charles is a redhead. So wait, we were trying to talk about the difference between Gymnos and Geos and husbandry and care and all that kind of stuff. Acricthes heckeli is a fish that needs a little bit of attention. They might win the award for the most regent of the group. They're gorgeous, beautiful, elegant fish. But big, up in to the 8-inch range, they can get fin extensions on their fins in the 5 or 6-inch range. So if they're kept in too small of a tank, you don't get the majesty of what that fish is.
Earlier when you referenced streamers,
yeah,
on fish, is that what you mean? Fin extensions?
Yes.
Yes.
Yep.
Is that kind of off the dorsal fin? Is that
off the dorsal, and then the lyre tail look, which is where the top and the bottom extend out, those can get extensions on them that are like...
Is that on the caudal fin?
Yes.
Okay.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Beautiful fish. The smallest of them is going to be those Guanacaras, and that's a fish that I want to do a little bit of a... I want to get some of those in and learn more about those. I've never had the chance to get them in before, and I just saw that they are on our availability list this week.
Is that a hint, hint, wink, wink?
That is more than that to say, hey, Charles, get some.
You know, you could just say that.
I'm not hinting at all. I'm saying, hey, we need to get some of those this week. Yeah, because they seem like a really cool, smaller, more manageable fish. They are going to take a little bit of work, but not a ton more work.
Well, in that same vein, what is a species of earth eaters that you haven't seen in ages, something that's a holy grail, unattainable, or you wish it was around?
You know, for me, it's not necessarily a species. It's mature Juraparis.
Because
it's something I wish I could get my hands on.
Is that the species you said takes 4 years or something?
Exactly.
Yeah. So yeah, you don't often see them get to that point.
Right. It was an incomplete project. And that's what happens with Juraparis is people get them. They get excited about them. They keep them for about 3 or 4 years. And either something happens or they get bored with them or, you know, let's face it. If you're busting through fish species and you're trying a whole bunch of different things, having something in your fish room for 4 years.
It's a big commitment.
It is. It's huge.
Yeah.
So getting my hands on some big, healthy, mature Juraparis. And I see them come through as like 1 or 2. And the best way to get a good group of Juraparis is to grow them up together.
So if you're out there and you have these,
that's the,
and you want to win some brownie points with Ben,
there we go. Yeah.
We'll find a place to keep them.
Oh yeah, we will. Oh yes, we will find it. Yeah, that would be what I think would be those guys. I've never kept Biotodoma cupido to maturity, and that's another one that their cupid is the reference. They're beautiful when they mature, and so getting a mature group of those, that might be a thing with these guys is if you're thinking about them, don't look at what they look like when they're juveniles. Find the mature pictures of them, because that's really where they shine.
Cool.
Can you know what you're going to have, not what you're going to bring home.
Exactly.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Can I pick your brain a little bit?
Yes.
So I kind of am thinking about this in terms of like aquarium displays, because that's often how I like to keep my aquariums, and that's what interests me. If you were to come up with one off the top of your head, describe to me a display and what kind of species you would keep and kind of how you would go about doing that. And are there tank mates that you can keep with whatever species you have in mind?
Yeah. So let's go with a 120 so that it's big enough.
Is that the 4x2x2?
4x2x2.
Okay.
Yep. The middle of it needs to be mostly open and a sand bottom, right? And that middle needs to be open because these guys want to graze.
Think That's of, the dance floor.
It's the dance floor, yeah. Think of fish that want to go out into a pasture and graze. And so they want that kind of room. But put like 2 inches of sand. You don't have to be afraid about getting dead spots in the sand with these guys. So go a little deeper, but put some slate pieces scattered throughout, buried in the sand. And those substrate spawners are going to use those pieces of slate to spawn on.
How big do you want these slate pieces to be?
Oh, I don't know, 3-4 inches in diameter-ish. Maybe 3 inches by 4 inches, something like that.
Okay.
Oh, and then what? Probably I would build the edges up with like some big, thick pieces of like Mopani driftwood and maybe some rock built into that Mopani.
Mm-hmm.
To get something going behind there.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully you can set that up to protect maybe Vallisneria.
Ooh,
so
yeah.
If you get some areas behind that Mopani where you can get some dirt, plant Vallisneria, but then you need to cover the dirt with rocks and big enough rocks that the earth eaters can't move them because
they'll try.
They will try.
Yeah.
Yeah, they will try. And Vallisneria is probably something that'll grow in there like that. I did Anubias plants,
mm-hmm,
and epiphytes on the priest's driftwood, and that worked really, really well. And so some big, long, branchy pieces of manzanita coming out towards the middle of the tank to provide a little bit of an overhang type structure. I think that would be the value there. When I had them, I did manage to get my hands on a group of mature bleeding hearts. Not the bleeding hearts we have downstairs, but the true bleeding heart tetra can get 3.5 to 4 inches long.
Wow, I didn't know that.
They get surprisingly big, and they're beautiful. And those were big enough that the gerparis, when they were at the 5-inch range, didn't mess with them.
But you're saying they would try? Is this just a case of if it fits, they try?
If it fits, they try. And okay. I think that, I mean, that's, let's face it, that's the case with anything.
Most, yeah.
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 Even tangs will go after juvenile fish, right?
Yes, protein is protein.
Protein is protein. So find a group of tetras that are big enough that the geos can't mess with them. And I think you could get away with, if you started out with smaller, like Steindachneri or the peach-faced redhead tapajos, I think you could start those out small and grow those up with a tetra that's going to be a little bit more robust, and I bet that they would be just fine.
Cool.
I know it's not biotypic, but do you think these would pair well with like Congo tetras?
Yeah, I think they'd be fine.
Awesome.
I was thinking giant danios.
They would be fine.
Yeah?
Yep. Something big and robust. I think you could even get away with silver hatchetfish.
Ooh, that would be neat.
Interesting.
Their whole attitude is about looking down. So something that's completely at the surface, I really don't think that they would mess with them.
That would be a really interesting tank.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then a big group of Broca. Or
yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
A lot of the sites mentioned quarries as good tank mates for geos.
But they're so small.
They're so small that I wonder if that would be okay. And then I think you could also get it with like Acaras or one of the other medium-sized South American cichlids, although you'd have to get rid of the Vallisneria with a lot of those medium South American cichlids. Chocolate cichlids could be really cool in a tank like that. Even Dempseys.
What would the lighting look like this? In my head, I'm picturing kind of like a play on lighting with some shadows, or would you like just kind of a fully lit tank?
Oh, no, I'd light it with a Kessel at an angle.
Yeah, that's what I was picturing. Yeah,
I think that spot sunlight would be just really cool on those fish.
Cool.
Yep. Hefty filtration, because they are going to sift. Hefty mechanical filtration. They're going to make sure that every single possible particle in your aquarium is going to end up in the water column and therefore down into your filter.
Is this... Okay, so there's that eternal debate of like whether cotton floss is great or not great, because it's like it's so fine that it gets clogged really fast. Like, what's the mechanical filtration that's ideal for something that's stirring up dirt all the time?
Yeah, that's a challenge. And I think, you know, I think I would go with an Owazi,
mm-hmm,
because it's got that easily changed, easily clean mechanical filter.
The pre-filter, yeah. Yes,
but I would use the coarse, not the fine.
Okay.
Because I think it would clog just too fast.
Yeah, and think about it like this. The time you save not gravel vacuuming, you could just maintain your filter a little more.
Oh, yeah. You will never have to gravel vacuum.
Exactly. Exactly. So pick your poison.
Yeah.
Dude, doing a water change in a tank like that would be so fast. Like if you just took like a, like don't even take like a python with the bell on it, just like somehow jury rig it onto like one of those intakes of a filter and just go straight into a toilet and then fill it back up. It would be so fast.
Yeah. So what I did is I got a YouTube, not the website.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
The letter U and then tube, like a U-shaped tube. And I ran my hose, my python, through the inside of that.
Yes.
Right. And then I put a strainer on the bottom of that hose. So I could just use that as a hook and put it in the tank, and I could adjust the height of the in the water part, start the siphon and walk away, and just let the water change happen that way, and then just reverse it to fill it back up.
Love it.
Yep. That's a pro tip you usually have to pay for.
I know, right? It's free on the Watercross Aquarium Gallery podcast. Keep listening, because there's more.
Or if you're really cool, go to our merch website so that we can keep doing these pro tips.
Yeah, we should get one of those kits available, like get some of the YouTubes and some of the strainers, because that made water changes fast.
Cool.
Yeah.
Any more brain picking on your end there? You look like you're thinking.
Yeah, a little bit. I just have kind of general questions. Like you said you had success... what was that species you said you were breeding too prolifically? They were so prolific. So you don't separate the young? They do their own thing? Or?
The first couple of batches, I actually stripped the females.
But you can't find out.
Because you were scared there wouldn't be enough?
Yeah. I didn't need to. And
interesting.
And I would just, after a while, I was just letting the babies show up in the tank, and plenty of babies were showing up in the tank.
Cool.
Yeah. So stripping the female is kind of fun and a little scary.
Sounds scary.
Yeah.
Sounds tense.
It is. It's definitely tense, but I never hurt a single fish doing it.
You mean you never managed to hurt a fish with a specialized jaw morphology for dealing with rough materials and abrasion?
Well, you're making a lot of sense. Interesting. I did try and trip Cypricromus before, and every time I would go to catch them, they would swallow while I was catching them.
Oh my God.
Every time. I never successfully got Cypricromus. But with a Syndactyri, I would take one of our specimen cups type thing, and I'd fill that with water, catch the female out, pop her into there, and then gently pick her up with my left hand. I am left-handed. And kind of hold her head and use my right thumbnail to pry her jaw open. And then my left index finger kind of push on the bottom of her throat to push the eggs or baby fish out. And watching those baby fish pop out of that mouth was just, it's insane.
Yeah, that's weird. I can't even imagine what
that
is.
And with those guys,
like,
25 to 30 eggs or babies was not unreasonable.
Huh. So when you were stripping eggs, would you have to incubate them? Would you use like an egg tumbler or something?
I did. I had a little makeshift tumbler that I made.
Oh, cool.
With the cap parts of undergravel filters and some undergravel filter tubing, and then a nylon. Like a little section of women's nylon or people's nylon.
Yeah.
What does that do for the eggs? That are you trying to replicate them being held by the mother? Is that
you want them to remain oxygenated? Is my understanding.
Oh, just
so the whoever is whatever the female or the male that's incubating the eggs, they're constantly swooshing water over those eggs.
Sure.
So you'd set up what's called an egg tumbler, and if you could imagine a section of undergravel filter lift tube with something on the bottom to keep things from falling out. And then, did I do two? I did two. So two of those, right? On that section of lift tube, the caps, and on the bottom of the lift tube, I would put a piece of nylon and push that into the cap that would be now the bottom one, so it would be upside down, and then take airline and run that through the top one, right, so it's touching the nylon, so every bubble that would come out would kind of bounce that nylon and would pull water through the bottom part of that lift tube. That lift tube's got little grates on it, mm-hmm. to keep the eggs from falling out, and that would pull the water through and keep those eggs bouncing and tumbling.
Cool. You had pretty good success with that?
Yeah, too good. And I did a lot of Malawi cichlid mouth brooders like that, and then the geos like that, and it worked really well.
Cool.
It's easier to collect fry than eggs. And so if you kind of track your females and wait about 9 days before you strip them, you're probably going to get fry, not eggs.
Yeah. I don't think it's something I could ever do myself. I might do it once just to say I did, but I, like, on a philosophical level, don't really like stripping because I don't like the idea of, like, inadvertently selecting fish that don't have that parental care anymore.
I get that, but I think so many of our fish already don't have that, that if you want, if you're really going to get into mouth brooders, you're going to end up at some point with a female or male that's just not going to hold, and you want to raise the babies. You're going to support what you want to.
Yeah, and I get that's true for a lot of like the Malawi strains, but if you're working with like a wild caught geo, like do you really want to start that process?
Right. 1 hour.
Yeah, I get it. I don't know. When you strip that first one, it's like almost addicting. It's so cool to see those baby fish go popping out of that parent's mouth. It's just, it's really fun.
And it is just kind of maximizing your yield, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. So, I would say if I would let them grow up in the tank, I would probably get half as many.
Yeah, it depends on what your intent is with your project. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Quantity, quality. Yeah.
Or it maybe it's not even a quantity, quality. It's just what you think is fun. If you think stripping is fun, then do it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you think it's scary, you don't have to. You know what I mean?
You like, might not have to. It might be with certain fish that if you want to get fry from those fish, you might have to strip.
And when you say certain fish, do you mean certain species or a specific individual?
I would say both, but certain species.
Okay. But for me, that's the eternal thing with like fish breeding is what I think is fun doesn't necessarily vibe with someone else.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. What do you guys think? Is it time to set up a big mouth breeder tank?
Maybe.
I mean, I think we covered the gist of what they are. I know I mentioned that there's a group of earth eaters from Lake Tanganyika. Some other fish that could qualify as a mouth brooder, Therichthys meeki, which would be the firemouth meeki. They do some sand sifting that's a Central American cichlid. There are a couple of Malawi cichlids that do a little bit of sand sifting. It's not just isolated to those group of fish that we call the earth eaters.
Even the Pelvicochromis kind of do it. A lot of the literature I'm finding scientifically is that most of their diet in the wild is stuff they're pulling from the sand. And that's why I've started skewing really hard towards that pellet food that I recommended Robbie today.
Yeah. when I kept Calochroma staprozii, which is the one of the Tanganyikan earth-eating fish, the whole bottom of my aquarium looked like a golf ball. They were meticulous about where they sifted, and it was dimples. With the Stendachneri and the Juraparis, the whole thing was sifted. They were just grabbing every single pile and grabbing them again and shifting it all and sifting it all. But the Calochroma staprozii, they were grabbing specific areas.
Okay, so I just had a random thought. If these guys are sifting the sand as much as they are, does that mean that you need to account for the fact that there's probably not going to be massive bacterial, like nitrifying bacteria in your sand, and you need to compensate with more biological filtration in your filter?
You know, I never had that issue. I don't know that they're stripping the bacteria off of
okay,
the sand.
Okay, just making sure.
Yeah, I don't think that that's...
I mean, the bacteria live like as a film on particles, yeah. So it would surprise me if they couldn't. Yeah. My issue would be if those particles are colliding enough, would that harm them? I don't know.
I don't think it does.
Yeah. If you didn't have a problem with it, it's probably not an issue.
No, I never had an issue that time. Although right. That was back in the day when I actually did like lots of religious water changes and I had it set up so it was really easy to do it. And yeah.
Anyways.
It's a really cool group of fish. I think the one drawback on them is size. Well, okay, and you got to be really careful on how you plant the tank. It's not that you can't have a planted aquarium. It just has to be a very specifically planted aquarium.
My hope is that we inspired somebody enough that they give us a call and ask us to order them some cool earth eaters.
Yes, for sure. And the list, by the way, of earth eaters this week, I'm just going to go through it because it's, you know, Charles was talking about the new species showing up with the earth eaters. And as I go through this availability list from our amazing, awesome wholesaler, Geophagus species, Aporoma or Aporema. Never heard of that one. Satanoperca damon. Geophagus species Altocinu. Geophagus steindachneri and Geophagus pellegrini, which pellegrini is the yellow hump earth eater. Same group as the steindachneri. So there's this group and two of them are undescribed species that I've never heard of. And I think that's going to be what we're seeing with those wholesalers and those sources that get their hands on very hard to find fish. We're going to see undescribed earth eaters showing up on that list all the time. And then they do also have the banded acara, which is the Guanacara dacri, which is that little one, a smaller, I get distracted when I look at these lists, a smaller one. That's going to be a 4-inch earth eater. And I would put that fish in a 40 breeder. Just fine.
Question 33 long question mark.
I think that would be okay, but I like that 18 inch front to back. I
mean, fair.
I'm a sucker for that. I do 1 foot wide, 4 foot tanks. Cause we can fit a whole lot of them on good accessible shelves. Right. But I really like that 18 inch front to back.
Side. There's a reason why. So what you're saying is there's a reason why we have 33 longs downstairs and 40 breeders upstairs.
Yeah, that is exactly true.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly true. And particularly with something like an earth eater where you want that big open area up front. If you have a big open area up front and a 12 inch tank, that doesn't leave you a whole lot of room to aquascape anything.
Fair.
Whereas if you've got 18 inches front to back or 24, even better, then you've got a lot more room to aquascape.
Are these guys prone to jumping?
I wondered that as well earlier. I didn't really bring it up, though, at the time.
You know, mine were in an acrylic tank with a cover. So I don't know. I doubt it.
I would guess no, but...
Yeah. Typically, things that tend to stay towards the bottom aren't jumpers, although gobies sure are jumpers.
Yeah, but they look up all the time.
They do.
Yeah, and they look do. Jumpy, the shape of them.
Yeah.
I
don't know. Well, we have.
I'm only
we have
asking.
Bolivians.
We do.
We have Bolivians in an open top room list, so
without any issue.
No.
I only bring it up because there are some really weird shaped, larger rimless tanks that are 24 inches wide.
Yeah,
that could be cool.
That could make for some very cool displays.
Hmm.
Well, I want to see if anybody out there has Earth Eaters in any of their tanks. I've seen some pretty incredible displays of some Earth Eater aquariums, and they're amazing. Earth Eaters are fish that you keep for unique looks and for amazing personalities. That's why, that's one of the main reasons for keeping lots of different cichlids is the personality. And the Earth Eaters definitely have that really fun, really cool personality. Take a look at the watercolorsaquarium.com website. See if there's cool stuff you like. See if there's ideas for stuff we should be putting on that site if there's something you don't see. We've been moving a ton of really cool plants out of that site. That's been really exciting to see. Our Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast listeners group Facebook page is blowing up with lots of really cool comments and ideas. Some pictures of some incredible tanks out there.
The Blackwater ones, those were insane.
Those were sweet. Yeah, those were very cool.
Ben, is it worth maybe teasing that podcast idea we have coming up where we kind of want to poll the audience?
Yes. In fact, I was supposed to have the website or the email address ready, but we will have that ready soon. This is something that a project Nick is going to help us with. We're going to do a podcast that's going to be Ask Amy, Ben, and Charles. And so Nick is going to act sort of like a game show host. So soon we'll have a website set up where you can email questions to Nick. Anything you want. All right, he's going to vet the questions a little bit. But yeah, I told him he's allowed to be a little bit brutal.
Yep, I kind of want to say no holds barred here, but be responsible in what you say. But I want it to be a little funny, and I want it to be almost a little edgy. I want it to be, you know, interesting.
Yeah, I think so. But also, you know, we do want it to be about aquariums. So
ideally, but well, let's just say this. I will filter these questions, but we as a group will have a good laugh about the ones that don't make the cut anyways.
That's true. Right. And that's going to be done, off the cuff. So Charles, Amy, and I will have no idea what those questions are until Nick asks them on the podcast. So check that out. That is coming up.
If you have pictures of Gio's at home, Ben mentioned the Facebook page, please post them. We love seeing pictures of people's tanks.
Yeah, that's great. Did I cover everything? Check us out on Spotify. No, wait. Check us out on YouTube. Check us out on
TikTok, Facebook.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's usually Amy's job.
We have an Instagram too.
Yeah.
I should have made Nick do it.
No, you shouldn't have.
Oh, by the way, I got to do a shout out to Mandy. Mandy is our daytime assistant manager. And the photographs she has been taking of fish lately here in the shop, those are fantastic. Wonderful.
She took some pictures of the Stigmosa that I'm trying to weasel a spawn out of because the photos she took today are insane.
They're insane. They're awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. We heard a great photography talk at the AJA convention that we were at, and she definitely took some really good pointers home and has been using them really well.
Yep. She's rocking it out. So thanks a lot, Mandy. Nick, thanks for helping us out tonight.
Happy to.
Being a guest host, and we're drinking a couple of fat tires tonight. That's a tasty brew that brings me back.
And good luck listening to the hell of your own voice when you're editing.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I can only imagine.
All right. Well, we're looking forward to having Amy back soon. Otherwise, thanks a lot for listening. Let's have lots of fun and keep those hands wet.